The Tom Woods Show, episode 1345.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here. The Tom Woods Show.
Folks, if you're like me, one of the most demoralizing things is when someone utters the truth and then lamely apologizes. Well, not these folks. I've got a free ebook of stories from heroic professors who told the PC mob to go pound sand. Stories from Jordan Peterson, Michael Rechtenwald, and others. Check it out at againstthemob.com. Hey everybody, Tom Woods here. Man, are you in for a treat today. It's the making of Michael Malice. And if you don't know who Michael Malice is, well, this is going to be your gateway to the answer. He is, well, let's see, he's twice been voted the number one guest on the Tom Woods Show. How about that? Beating out even Ron Paul himself. And he and I have done a lot of interesting things together. Maybe the best known was the debate we had at the end of 2015 on the legacy of Alexander Hamilton. Now, I don't need to remind you how that debate turned out, but it was a tremendous time. We both enjoyed ourselves very much, as did the spectators. And the video of that debate, I'll try and remember to link to it on the show notes page, tomwoods.com/1345, because it is some fun watching. I mean, you could curl up at night with some popcorn and watch this debate, and you will be thoroughly entertained. Well, Michael Malice, as you may know, is a celebrity ghostwriter and a darn good one at that, a New York Times best-selling one. He is the author, furthermore, of a book in his own right called Dear Reader, the unauthorized autobiography of Kim Jong-il. He was the subject of Harvey Pekar's graphic novel Ego and Hubris, and he is a frequent television personality and, let's say, master of Twitter. I don't know how else to describe the Michael Malice Twitter account, but if you're not following it, well, that's a shame. All right, Michael Malice, welcome back.
Thanks, Tom.
I can't remember the last time I had you on. I've been on your show a couple of times, and I don't remember the last time I had you on. I guess it wasn't that long ago, but this one's going to be different from the others. We did a funny episode a long time ago when you were visiting in Florida, and you guest hosted the show, but I was the guest, so it was kind of funny. But then the next episode was me interviewing you, but taking questions from the audience. But what I've never done is what you did with me on that episode, where you were just asking me things, just, you know, who the heck I am and where I come from and, you know, all these kinds of interesting questions. I'd never really did that with you. So here we are. It took 1,345 episodes, but here we are. So I want to start off with your background. I mean, I think some people know a little bit about where you were born, but just give me a little bit of the chronology of, let's say, the first, where are you geographically in the first 10 years of your life?
I was born in Lvov, Ukraine, Soviet Union, which is where Mises is from, and which is where Masoch of Masochism is from. We moved here to the States, to Brooklyn, when I was about 1.5 or 2, Bensonhurst specifically, and I stayed there until about, 10 years of age. I look back at it very fondly.
So what do you mean when you say sometimes that you grew up in a Soviet household? You're talking about a household that has absorbed like some of the outlook or the texture of life of the Soviet Union. What does that really mean, especially when you're transplanted to another society?
Well, we spoke Russian at home, and it was me, my parents, and my grandparents. Everyone very much had a certain outlook that in many ways I would say is, and I use this word very carefully, alien to the American mindset. So a lot of the stuff that kind of I was taught and was taken for granted growing up is very, very different from the American attitude. And it's something I only realized not that long ago when I was talking to my buddy Rob Mons, who's a filmmaker, works for Reason in the past. And, you know, he was making the point that there's this subtle racism, because when you talk about people who are Asian, you know, you assume that their culture is weird, but Russians are white and they wear suits, you know, kind of thing. So it's like, oh, they're just basically like the French. And we are really Martians compared to Americans in many ways. The mindset is very, very different.
Give me an example of that. What's something that would surprise us?
Well, I feel like most of the examples Americans would find abhorrent. So one of the ideas, and this is the example I've used many times in the past, is if I gave you an apple, right, there's a lot of things you could do with it. You would eat it, you could make it applesauce, you could put it in the fridge, right? It is a list of things. it wouldn't even enter your head to just bash it into your face. It's just, I mean, you could do that in a literal sense, but it's just not something that would present itself to you psychologically. And my buddy John was staying at my house, and in my building, there's only 3 apartments. So if you're in the building, someone had to have let you in. And I went to the gym and I came back. And he said that there was a guy in the hall, you know, knocking on the door looking for whatever, Jeff. And it was just shocking to me because he's very, very blue blood American, like true blue American. If I was staying at someone's house, the possibility of me opening the door is really akin to you bashing an apple into your head. It wouldn't even present itself as an option.
Ah, I see. Just even something like that.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense to me. I wouldn't even think of it. You know what I mean? Like in retrospect, it makes sense, but it's like, it wouldn't be in the menu of choices.
Is that just a Russian cultural thing or is that distinctly Soviet?
Well, I don't know. You know what I mean? The question has always been, did communism take stock in Russia because the Russian people are ready for it? Or is it, you know, the communists made the Russian people into what they are? I don't know. But I do know that there is, it's very different than the American approach.
What did your parents tell you, or did you ever ask them about what their lives were like in Ukraine before you were born?
Oh, the Ukraine.
Well, at that time, it would have been the Ukraine, right?
Yeah. Sure, I talk about it. I asked them a lot. I don't know what you mean specifically. I mean, they had enormous cynicism and contempt for it, as I think most, you know, people who left did. You know, it was Mike Cernovich who only in the last 2 years pointed out to me that I'm a refugee. That when we hear the word refugee, it's loaded with Middle East and race. And then he's like, no, you were a refugee also, but you don't think of it in those terms because you weren't fleeing a war and you were white.
All right. I suppose when people leave, naturally, you know, it's because of some unhappiness. But some people move to another place, not necessarily because they're unhappy, because the other place is better. I would assume you leave the Soviet Union because you're unhappy, right? I can't imagine people being thrilled. On the other hand, we hear all these reports about Stalin being viewed favorably by a lot of people. And, you know, so, I mean, I can't assume what people's views are just because they lived through it, because apparently some people think, you know, well, he did some good things for the country.
I don't think that was the mentality already by the late 70s. I think at that point, maybe if you were like even marginally intelligent, you really understood what the heck was going on. And the example my mom gave me, you know, I asked her about this not that long ago, and she'd be like, look, 1 year they would talk about how this one historical figure is like the bee's knees, and the next year he's a class traitor and terrible, and then he'd be rehabilitated or something. And you'd smile and nod, and you didn't have to have much of an intellect to realize this is all nonsense, and the stories just contradict each other. So especially, you know, being told how great everything is and you're cold and hungry, it's just like, yeah, okay, cool story, bro. So there was no veneration of Stalin at all in my family. I know that there was that where they lived. My mom talked about it. People were like, oh, you know, Papa Stalin, oh my gosh. And she was just like, yeah, okay. I mean, it was just ridiculous to her and to my dad even more.
So what year are we talking about when we say when you got here? What was that?
78.
78. Okay. So you weren't, because I know there were a number of Russian Jews who were allowed to emigrate around 74. You weren't part of that?
I think we were.
Okay.
I think there was a multi-year thing. Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. All right. So here you are in the United States.
Yeah.
And you, I guess, I read Ego and Hubris, and it's hard to find these days, folks, but—
Oh, it's easy to find. It's just extremely expensive.
That's true. Yeah. I think I actually got it for a decent price in the super old days, and I cherish my copy.
Well, all prices are decent, Tom. You know that, value subjective.
I know. What's the matter with me? All right, way to catch me on that. But having read that, I know stuff about your upbringing that most people don't. So what I loved about that book was how early in your life I saw the Michael Malice I know emerging.
Well, I was the same size.
Yeah, that's true. But honestly, stories from your childhood were making me either hiss at the people who were, you know, harassing you in one way or another, or just being idiots that you had to deal with, or cheering you on. So tell me about the schooling that you had.
I mean, where do we even start? There's a lot of school stories in there, and it's just one after another.
Well, what kind of school were you going to, first of all?
Oh, I went, my parents, you know, coming from a communist country, knew well enough not to put me in public school. So they sent me to yeshiva, which is Jewish school. So half the day was in Hebrew, half the day was in English. So I was trilingual by the time I was in first grade, which I think is the best thing ever when kids learn more than one language, because then they learn to think conceptually instead of thinking and getting trapped in puns and linguistic traps. So it was Yeshiva Flatbush, which is in Flatbush, Brooklyn. I stayed there until fourth grade and then switched to public school in fifth grade, which was quite a culture shock. Then I went to, you know, a gifted program for junior high and then to Stuyvesant for high school.
How old were you when you learned English?
I learned it, I mean, by kindergarten. So, you know, three or four. I learned it by watching television.
All right. So let's back up a little bit. So you go to a Jewish school for several years. First of all, how central to the life of your own household was the fact of your being Jewish?
Well, it got us out of Russia, but it's not like there was any celebrating of holidays. It's not like we kept kosher or anything like that at home.
Yeah, but they could have sent you to a plain vanilla private school, and yet they didn't.
No, because I got a scholarship. We were desperately poor.
Oh, well, that doesn't hurt. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I had to take this big test before kindergarten, like one-on-one with the principal.
Wow. Okay.
I remember it distinctly. It was really funny because, like, there were questions like, you know, range these blocks. And he's like, which planet has rings? And I knew it was Saturn. The one question I didn't get, I remember, was knowing how to say suspenders in English, because obviously that's a term I would only have heard from my family when they put them on me. And it was actually really funny because on my show Nightshade, I was doing a segment on Jupiter and I had a picture of Saturn. You know, I always make those intentional mistakes.
Right.
And someone tweeted at me to correct me. And they're like, I know you make mistakes on purpose, but this one was actually a mistake and you're covering for the producer. It was amazing. And he started arguing and yelling at me when I was like, I couldn't even. And the fact that it was specifically over Saturn, which was
right,
thing I knew before I even went to school. It was like really kind of this cool. It was amazing.
Do you have any memories of that school that are fond or that make you contemptuous or anything that still stands out after all these years?
Oh, I have a lot of phenomenally positive memories. That's when we had a good library. Well, no, I went to that library in the public library. That's when I fell in love with reading. I just recently acquired, or I'm about to acquire, a piece of art from a Beverly Cleary book that I adored as a kid. So original art. So, I mean, that stuff kind of stuck with me. I remember, here's something that's kind of Soviet that would answer your question. In second grade, we had a contest to see who could read the most books, right? Whichever kid reads the most books gets a prize. Well, I was smart enough, and this is how Russians think. I'm like, all right, I'm just going to read kindergarten level books. I can plow through them in 5 minutes. And since it's about volume, I demolished everybody else. It was ridiculous. I was reading three books a day.
Did I read this in Ego and Hubris? Because this story sounds very familiar.
Probably.
Okay. Yeah.
And what was even shocking to me is as I was doing this, no one else was picking up on what I was doing. It was just that whole gaming the system mentality is very much a Russian approach to doing things and doing it with a sense of pride as opposed to regarding it as something shady or, you know, shameful. It's like the idea is the system is there to exploit you. So you better take what you can out of it in return. And that's I think that would definitely be a function of, you know, decades of Soviet upbringing. In kind of evolutionary approach, the people who don't think like that, they're the ones who kind of probably died.
What would you say, looking back on your education up until you graduated from high school, was there anything during that time that you would say helped to form the way you think? And it could be not just what you were taught, but just the institutional environment in which you operated, the schools themselves.
Sure. There's a couple of things. This one is in Ego and Hubris. In fifth grade, there was a girl in my class, Bonnie, and she was teaming up with my friend Michelle, and they started making fun of me. And I said to Bonnie the most offensive thing I could think of, and I didn't know what it meant at the time, but I said it. And she told her dad, and I didn't know who her dad was. Her dad was a cop. So he's out of uniform in his, you know, members only jacket after school one day, going to kid after kid. Then he goes to me and grabs me by the collar. And starts telling me you're going to go to jail, how dare you, all this other stuff. And I made it a point to look at him and laugh in his face, even though I was 10 years old. And this is one of those moments where you like lose faith in your parents. I got home and told them and they looked at each other and they were like, oh, you should have done that. But they were like, kind of like, oh my gosh, you know? And I am so proud of myself for having done that. And that guy should be in a tomb. I mean, to put his hands on a child and threaten them with this? I mean, you are an unconscionable monster.
Is that the first time you looked at the police in a different way?
No, because the first time I had an interview where I realized how different my upbringing was, I was doing an interview in 2005 with BBC Radio. And the question was, oh, on your website, you make a lot of fun about with police. Is that something you've gotten a lot of heat about? And again, this is me being naive and stupid. You know what I mean? But I totally did not think this was not trying to troll them. I said, well, it's like my dad always told me, no matter where you go in the world, no matter where you find yourself, the stupidest people are always the cops. And the host audibly gasped and said, Michael, this is a family show. As if I was, you know, talking about, you know, child abuse in a glib way and changed the subject immediately. So that was one of the things that you're taught that's very different from American, this idea of respecting the police. And as an adult, I've thought about it. And if you think about it, if you look at how corrections officers are viewed, I mean, they're around criminals far more than police officers. Their lives are more at risk than police officers. No one thinks they're heroes. I mean, it's a low status job. I mean, it's a tough job. More credit people who are doing it, that's fine, but you don't venerate them. So the idea of this veneration of police, or like I would watch cartoons as a kid and they'd be like, if you have a problem, talk to a cop. It was nonsensical to me, and it remains so.
I have to say, I'm curious about the high school social life of Michael Malice, because today, those people who follow you, they know kind of who you are and what you're about. And I mean, Donald Trump Jr. wants to follow you on Twitter. But yeah, none of that stuff exists.
He doesn't follow you, Tom?
He doesn't. I'm not verified. So
you're not verified.
The question
how do I know it's
itself.
Really your account? Yeah. Maybe it's some regular dope.
Yeah. Well, it's completely unfunny. That's how you know.
I thought that was the Murphy account.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good one. So I guess I want to know, all right, so you didn't have, I mean, I associate with you, not just your writing and speaking and stuff, but also, I mean, the trolling is at master level, but that doesn't really exist at the time that you're in high school. So what are you known for? What are you known for in high school?
Oh, no. My high school was Stuyvesant. So to get into Stuyvesant, it's based on one thing. Everyone in New York City who wants to takes a test, and the top whatever percentile get to go to Stuyvesant. So it's purely based on this one test, which correlates pretty well with intelligence. So all the kids are bright, not all the teachers necessarily, but there's a lot of very high quality teachers there. And having bright kids, is, I'm sure, helps them become better teachers as well. I mean, and it's just a serpent eating its own tail, so to speak, that's a dumb metaphor, sorry. Anyway, so I did have very much a reputation of being a obnoxious loudmouth who had fun with it. And I was pretty popular in high school, I'm not going to lie.
I already know the answer to this question. Do you go to your reunions?
Oh, God, no.
Yeah, okay. I knew. I'm glad I know you well enough to know the answer to that question. All right.
I keep in touch with a fair amount of people from high school, far more than from college.
Yeah, so you figure, what's the point of the reunion? I can see these people if I want to.
Or I could just go on Facebook and reconnect with somebody, but there's no one. And I mean, it's going to be the dregs.
I like going to my reunions.
Oh,
it's fun.
Like I said, it's the dregs.
I know. I gave you that. That was a freebie. All right. So you're 18 years old at this point. How similar is your thinking when you're 18 to when whatever age you are now?
I was much more of a Republican then, or I was kind of a Republican then. But I mean, my psychology and my approach to life, I think if you talk to people who knew me then, it would be quite similar. Except now I have a Patreon and actually pays my rent. Back then it was a source of social strife, but you know, that's a whole other story.
How did you become a Republican in those days? What was the thing that made you think differently from everybody else, from most people, let's say?
My buddy gave me the Rush Limbaugh book. And he was so good at getting people upset, like the kind of people I hated, getting them upset, that I thought it was so funny. And again, to be this kind of obnoxious Republican in New York City public schools is there any easier way to troll people? So that was the start of it. But then, you know, as soon as you start in that place and you examine it, it's very hard to maintain that spot intellectually. It collapses pretty quick. So then it was just reading, you know, Rand. And my freshman year at college, I found the laissez-faire books, you know, that paper pamphlet somewhere. And I went through it and I ordered a lot of stuff and, you know, and interning at the Cato Institute, and the rest is history.
Can you say a word about, because I just have to ask you after reading Ego and Hubris, can you say a word about Bucknell University?
Sure. Going to Bucknell was probably the worst mistake of my life. And I hate that expression because it sounds like you're exaggerating. But I think most people, if they sat down and said, what were the big mistakes in your life? You'd come up with five, right? There's only like, you're not going to have that many big mistakes. I had never been around WASPy white people before. I didn't realize what they were like. I thought I was a conservative, and they were unconscionably horrible. And there was no one there. They had no minds whatsoever. It's a mentality and approach that I still kind of find. And I don't mean you're a conservative in your way, but you know what you like, and you'll hear out other ideas. Them, it's like, if I hadn't heard it, it's by definition bad. It's this kind of weird mental loop that they have, and they're just really excruciatingly terrible people. And this speaks to the fact that I'm one of the like 10 most famous Bucknell alums. That's not a testament to my accomplishments, which are meager. It's a testament to the fact that you have so many bright, hardworking young people who do not leave their mark because they have no creativity, and they're just the cogs in the corporate machine.
I wish I had it. Doggone it, I wish I had my copy of Ego and Hubris. It's in a box because of different moves and stuff. I know exactly where it is, but in there, you reproduce a letter that you wrote.
Oh, yes. About, I have framed.
Okay, can you tell people about that letter? Because when I saw that, I just laughed uproariously at the realization that you actually sent this letter.
Wait, you mean the letter I received?
Oh, no, I'm talking about the letter that you wrote about the person that you want to have as an advisor. And if you get such and such as an advisor, you're going to – you remember that one?
Yeah, of course. So there was a Professor Bucknell, Professor Miller, who I called the fat fascist. And he was a real second – he was a real mediocrity as a person. And I knew it at the time then. And looking back, he's even more of a miserable loser now. I can say that with absolute certainty. And he taught Business 101, and he basically, you know, like a lot of these academics, he wanted to have a textbook and no one wanted to print his textbook. So he basically made a binder that we all bought or he handed out, I don't remember, with all, you know, he wrote out and Xeroxed this textbook for us that he wrote. And the symbol for the class was the Mitsudoya, which is the Japanese 3-in-1. Like yin and yang is 2, this is 3, 50% better. And his whole point was that business is a mix of effectiveness, efficiency, and community, which is just commie bullshit, so pardon my French. And the point being, like, you need all three. It's just like, well, that's not how you make decisions. You have to put them in a hierarchical order. And if you have a business that is effective and has poor community, as opposed to a business that has good community but is ineffective, these are not equally valid choices. And you know, he had just like the yin and yang, like they feed into each other. This symbol is the three of them feeding each other. And I told we were going to have once you just you declare your major at Bucknell at the end of freshman year or during freshman year. And I chose to be a business major because that would be the best credential. And you have to write asking for who you want. And I said to them, if you give me John Miller as my faculty advisor, I will burn this school down.
That letter was so unbelievable. And today, of course, you'd be, you know, somebody'd come knocking on your door if you sent a letter like that.
I think it was like that then too, but I didn't care.
I loved that letter. All right, so you get out of Bucknell.
God, he's such a loser. I mean, I still think about the thing is, you know what it is, Tom? It's that when you're a kid and you're young, you don't have the perspective to think, okay, maybe I just don't like this person, but they're a great man. And then when you're older and you achieve something in your life, you look back, you're like, I was being so mild. He is such a pathetic, ugly person in every way. Just I mean, really like this Ellsworth Chewy type.
Oh, well, so you're no doubt glad to get out of there. But what did you do immediately upon graduating? What did you go into?
So I, you ever play Plinko on Price is Right? You know that game?
I've watched more Price is Right than I want to admit. But yes, of course.
Okay. So for those who don't know, Plinko is basically like you slide the disc at the top of the board, and then it bounces around and lands in one of the slots at the bottom. And basically, it's like a bell curve distribution, right? Most of the slots will go in the middle two, then less, fewer in the other two, and then wider and wider. And the far two slots are the rarest to get, and those are the most money. And I realized, okay, there are jobs that pay well that are great and fun, and there are jobs that pay well that are horrible, and there are jobs that pay little and are horrible, and there are jobs that pay little but are fun. So I thought, if I bounce around enough, I'm going to hit the one that I want. So I was a temp, and I was making good money very quickly. I would just leave jobs that I thought, nah, this isn't it. And I was a Y2K consultant. It was my first real gig.
Ah, wow. So at the time, did you think that this was a big deal and companies needed to be Y2K compliant or disaster was going to strike?
I didn't really think about it one way or another. I thought the fears were overblown. I remember specifically arguing with my boss, Barbara, and she was making the point that, like, what happens when, like, electronic doors in supermarkets can't open? And she was literally making the point that there's going to be, I remember this very clearly, like, people are going to riot because they can't get their Entenmann's, like pastries. And which is, it's like, you know, you can unscrew those doors, right? Yeah, I mean, if worse, let's suppose Y2K happens and you can't open the doors electronically, you can figure out ways to get the doors off the hinges. This is hardly an insuperable task. And I remember my friend Steph, who I did go to high school with, who I'm still friends with, and she was saying, oh, you know, I hear that these nukes might go off. And I said, let me ask you this. If you're designing nukes, why would the default setting, if something goes bad, be fire?
Yeah, right, exactly.
Wouldn't the default setting be, if something goes wrong, don't do anything? Like, you really have to go through a lot of hoops to make it fire?
Yeah. No, it's funny the way we're just inclined to think these wild things. And then as soon as you sit down and give it a little bit of thought, well, yeah, it probably wouldn't be that way.
Right.
But at the time, I was really concerned about it. And to this day, I'm actually not sure why there wasn't a bigger problem with it. I mean, on the surface, but then when we watched the new year flip into 2000 and all these countries that you knew darn well weren't spending a dollar on Y2K remediation,
right,
and they were going just fine. The lights were still on.
Oh, yeah. Thought,
okay. All right. This is going to turn out fine. All right. Exactly. So what would you say was your most memorable, was there a particularly memorable occupation you had before you started doing the ghostwriting?
Memorable?
Like you look back and say, you know, it isn't something I did for a living, but I'm glad I had that experience.
It sounds like you're hinting at something and I don't know what it is.
I don't either. I just want to know before I don't want to skip over an important part of your life. So I want you to tell me.
I don't think that there was any job I had that I look back particularly reverently.
So at what point did you say, because going into ghostwriting is really not an easy thing to get into. I mean, it's especially hard to start from zero because who's going to want you as a ghostwriter if you don't have a paper trail? And, you know, it's a kind of like a catch-22. So at what point did you decide that was something you wanted to do?
It's not that I decided. It was kind of fell into my lap in a way. I had a book proposal that went out, and Jeremy Ruby Strauss, who discovered Tucker Max, he discovered Maddox. He's the one who discovered Neil Strauss. He's the one who told Neil Strauss to write The Game. And Neil Strauss had been a Rolling Stone writer, and he gave him the Marilyn Manson book, which was number one. And I think Motley Crue, he gave him. Jeremy is one of the most amazing people I've ever met. And he had a book proposal of mine that he really liked. And they said, well, we're doing a book that's too similar to this. And he said, well, don't you want to sell both Coke and Pepsi and leave RC Cola to somebody else? And he goes, no. So he needed a ghostwriter for that book, and he couldn't get rid of the writer who was on it. So then he offered me the Matt Hughes one, and co-authoring that was one of the great privileges of my life.
Now remind people who Matt Hughes was, or is, sorry, he's still alive.
He's a UFC Ultimate Fighting Champion, Hall of Famer, 9-time world champion.
So that went pretty well. That was a good experience, and plus, in meeting Matt Hughes, I remember you've told me how meaningful that was for you because
he's
the kind of person that on paper, an outside observer would think, oh, these two aren't going to get along. And the opposite occurred.
Yeah. I got along with him and his whole family. I adore them. I mean, they're from rural Illinois. They're wonderful people. Even Jordan, he's pretty good, despite what you might have heard. I still chat with them. They're just great. And so it really also as a function of this, whenever I hear New Yorkers in media, like kind of have this little disdain for like rural areas of the Midwest, it really is personal for me. And it really triggers me.
Folks, we're going to take a break from Michael Malice to hear from my daughter, Regina. I've really been enjoying Curiosity Stream, which was founded by John Hendricks, the founder of the Discovery Channel. It features documentaries on science, nature, history, technology, society, and lifestyle. And I absolutely love it. You just can't stop watching it. So I asked my daughter, Regina, to take a look. Regina, which documentaries did you find most enjoyable?
There was one about Pluto and how they built a spacecraft to go to Pluto. And then there was one on the journey for like a human from being a newborn all the way to adolescence, which was really cool, actually.
Was it about their physical development or psychological development?
It was both psychological and physical.
And I know also you were telling me you really liked The Selection.
I could be learning about the correlation between creativity and mental illness. And then I'm done with that. I learn about the kidney's real function in the body. It's amazing.
Now, I know when I told you here, go watch some documentaries, you probably thought, I don't know if I want to do this. And then it turned out to be great.
I started watching them. I realized, holy cow, these are all great. I'm learning so much. And now I'm not crying while I do my algebra homework because, you know, at least I'm learning something while I'm doing it. I really loved it.
So head on over to curiositystream.com/woods for unlimited access to the world's top documentaries and nonfiction series. And for my listeners, enter promo code WOODS when prompted during the sign-up process, and your membership is completely free for the first 30 days. That's curiositystream.com/woods, promo code WOODS. I have to ask, before we go on, there's something I want to ask you about ideas. I mean, here we are talking about certain events in your life, but you mentioned that you read Ayn Rand. And I've always wanted to ask you this, because I'm not sure I've totally known the answer.
I do not approve of surprises.
Well, too bad. All right. I guess I want to know, which Randian ideas do you think are for you the most important and that, you know, help to shape your own thinking? And which ideas do you think are either secondary to her thought or you just flat out disagree with?
That's a very big question. I mean, we did an episode about Rand, so...
Right, and that'll be linked on the show notes page.
I hear that. I think the ones that are most... I agree with and are most important for me personally is this idea that your life is extremely important. And you should do the most of it that you can. And that like productive work in some sense is man's highest moral accomplishment. So that, and also this sense of integrity being not only the right thing to do, but the practical thing to do. I think those are some really important Randian ideas. The ideas that I find less important, I think she... And Nathaniel Brandon, her second in command before they had their falling out, he talked about this. She really, when you're young, it's kind of hard to separate the wheat from the chaff with Rand. And there's a lot of this idea that you can be perfectly happy being completely isolated and self-contained. And that's a really bad message to tell young people, even if it's not on purpose.
I find in general that these days you mention Rand's name, you can't even get a conversation going with most people. Now, those people I don't want to have conversations with, but in general, her name has been made so toxic. And yet when you look back, or let's say 10, 20 years after Atlas Shrugged came out, as you know, because I've watched it at your urging, she was on Donahue, she was on with Johnny Carson, and they would all say, now, you know, I don't agree with her philosophy, but she's a very interesting and intelligent woman. The editor of Random House, Bennett Cerf, was kind of an establishment liberal in his day,
sure. And
he didn't agree with her, but he held her in very high regard. So I find that fascinating that at the time, people felt intimidated by her in a way, and they felt like this is an important thinker who deserves to be heard one way or the other. Whereas today, it's like she is the caricature of what a libertarian is, even though she didn't even consider herself a libertarian. But Salon cannot write an article against libertarianism without mentioning Ayn Rand derisively. What's going on here?
I don't agree with your assessment at all. During her lifetime, she was really made into a complete pariah. It started with Whittaker Chambers comparing her to Auschwitz. I mean, there was, when I was in Bucknell, I went through and found all the articles about her that were contemporary. And there was like the crazy cult of paranoid Ayn Rand. They called her a cult. They talked about, you know, how all the her people around her. She was really persona non grata. And in fact, Tom Snyder in, I think it's 79 or 80, has her on his show. And he goes, there's people out there who think you're nuts. And she goes, no, they want you to think it. And he goes, oh, yeah, gotcha. Like, and he got it. So she was very much treated as a, I mean, what was her name? That film director, the female film director, I forget her name, said, Atlas Shrugged is, or The Fountainhead is not a book to be put down lightly. It should be thrown with great force. So, I mean, she was very, very much attacked in her lifetime. And now there's enough people who have read her, and thanks to the internet, who can defend her, that, I mean, the idea that she'd be read in high school back then, I think, is an impossibility because she's such a loon. And in fact, it was Jerome Tichilli who wrote the book, It Usually Starts with Ayn Rand. And his whole premise is, you know, the 50s, there's this big consensus. And in his words, Ayn Rand came and said F you to Dwight Eisenhower. And she said, all these things that you guys think we're all agreed on, well, I'm not agreeing to it. What happens now? In fact, there's a quote I have from Mike Wallace, which is the preface to chapter 2 of my forthcoming book. This is her first big interview. And it's an amazing clip where he goes, you know, reviews have said you are out to destroy every edifice in the typical American way of life. Our rule by majority will, our government regulated capitalism. Other reviews said you scorn churches and the concept of God. Are these accurate criticisms? And she goes, yes. So she was very much attacked in her lifetime. And she even said when Atlas Shrugged came out, verbatim, we cannot count on one single good review.
All right, I hear you. And that's a really, really good answer. At the same time, The Fountainhead is made into a movie with Gary Cooper in it. She is actually on with Tom Snyder, which is the thing. She's on with Carson. She's on with Donahue. Now, on the other hand, that in itself, I suppose, doesn't prove anything because I bet these people either had Louis Farrakhan on their shows or the equivalent. So that in itself doesn't prove anything. But our people today can't get on those shows. There was something to her that made people feel like, I mean, as I say, Bennett Cerf says in his memoirs that this is a brilliant woman. Those are his words.
Okay. So let's flesh out the rest of this Bennett Cerf relationship. Which is Bennett Cerf told her, apparently, you can write whatever book you want, we'll publish it. And her follow-up to Atlas Shrugged was a book to be called The Fascist New Frontier, comparing JFK to Hitler.
Right. And so he claimed that he was talking about fiction books she could write.
And this was after he was shot, I believe. So and you got to give Bennett Cerf a little credit. It's like, you know, maybe comparing JFK to Hitler isn't exactly what I had in mind, Ayn. So – and again, he also, I think he said explicitly, he found her philosophy to be barbaric.
Yeah, at the very least, I think he might have called it a cockamamie philosophy.
Sure.
At the very least. Yeah. All right. Well, anyway, I'm interested in that, interested in how influential she was for you, because it's interesting that in my circles, and you and I have, it would be an interesting Venn diagram to look at the different circles you and
I
travel.
Wait, I just got to ask you though, what do you mean like our people can't get on these shows? Like I'm on TV.
That's true, but most of our people can't get on, what's the equivalent of Johnny Carson?
Yeah, but the point is they don't have people like Rand on. They wouldn't have any lefty, like intellectual, like, I mean, it's few and far between.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah,
they're not having Bret Stephens on or maybe they have a
true
book.
I think Johnny Carson may have had Paul Ehrlich on to talk about the population bomb.
Whereas, he absolutely did, more than once.
Whereas you're right, it would be – could you imagine who's the nitwit who's on there? Jimmy Fallon. I mean, they're worse than Jimmy Fallon. He's fine in some ways. But could you imagine him having somebody like this on, or Julian Simon? I guess that's a good point, is that type of guest – is more or less absent. It's all movie stars and musicians.
Yeah, and comics.
Yeah. Jeez, I didn't even, yeah, that's phenomenon is happening right before my eyes. I didn't even notice it. All right, so then let's move to the part of your life where the real turning point in your life when you meet Tom Woods. Let's get out of here.
It's all downhill from there.
I mean, the thing that you're known for the most out of everything, I think at this moment anyway, as we're recording this, is your work on North Korea, because you've talked about it a lot. You wrote Dear Reader. You've had a tremendous amount of media appearances on it. You've been a great public speaker on the subject, great advocate on that subject. And I'm curious about what drew you to that particular topic of all topics.
Well, being Jewish and being born in the Soviet Union, those were two chances for me to have been in a concentration camp. So knowing that the camps are still on Earth right now, and there but for the grace of God kind of thing, and that the people in the United States and the West were looking at them as a laughingstock, that really, you know, got under my skin. And the more I researched, the more I realized how absolutely horrible it is and how someone needs to do something. And the point I made, and I've made this to you and many other places, is if I move the needle here, who cares? It's not going to have much change. But if I move the needle a little bit there, this could have profound life-saving consequences. So it was the kind of thing where the ratio between cost and benefit could not be higher, because it's the worst place on Earth. So, you know, that really, it's the kind of thing where it's like, okay, when you die, what's your legacy going to be? It's like, yes, sure, I co-authored a bunch of books that I'm extremely proud of with some amazing people. But it's also, okay, I swung for the fences on an issue that matters an enormous amount to me and should matter to anyone who cares about liberty at all. And I don't even mean a libertarian. And I knew this. There was no question in my mind that no matter where you stand politically, you're going to say North Korea needs more liberty. This is not really in dispute. You're not going to have, you know, the reaction is unanimous horror and recoil.
Did you enjoy writing that book?
It was the hardest thing I've ever done.
Yeah. But I can think of hard projects that I hated and hard projects that, as I was doing them, I thought, yeah, this is the you know what, this is where it's at. What was it like for you? And you had a self-imposed deadline, I assume, right? Because you self-published that book.
Yeah, I did a Kickstarter, raised 30 grand. Most books I write 300 pages, it ended up being 400 pages. I had to condense 60 books into a narrative and have it be entertaining and have it be in the first person and cover everything you need to know about North Korea. So this, it took all my skills that I had developed over years as a writer.
So when it was finished, how did you reward yourself?
I don't know how I did reward myself, because finishing the book, then you have to edit it, then you have to design it, then you have to, you know, do all this other stuff. I don't know that I really kind of did reward myself particularly. I'm sure I bought something as a treat to myself, which is something I tend to do when I do these accomplishments, but I don't remember what that was.
I'm going to go out of order just because I can. There are a couple more things that I skipped over that I want to get to. One is, and I know you've told the story before, but I just want to get it on the recording. We've made mention a couple of times of a book called Ego and Hubris by Harvey Pekar, who was, when it comes to graphic novels, he's the guy.
Yeah.
How does it happen that you have a graphic novel written about your life by him?
You haven't?
I don't have a blue check mark. What do you expect?
No, Harvey was a great mentor to me, great person. When I met him, we hit it off. And at first, he wanted to write a book comparing his family's experience coming over in the early 20th century to my wave of Eastern European immigration. And then basically, there was enough stories that, you know, the whole book was me. I was the first person he wrote a graphic novel about other than himself. So it was a great honor of my life. Now it goes for, the price has been skyrocketing the last few months. Now the cheapest copy, as we're talking, is $150. And people are paying it. It's not like it's for $150 sitting there. Someone just bought it on eBay for $100. And then someone bought it for $120. It was just in the last 2 weeks. It's just crazy to me. I would not pay that much money for that book, is my point.
When I read it, of course, you know this, but listeners won't. When I read it, I was texting you responses as I was reading it.
Yep.
I just there were particular stories that I loved, and I would write to you, and I was just having a great old time. I remember being in a hotel room. I forget what I was speaking at some conference or something. Couldn't have cared less about that. I was in my room reading Ego and Hubris, just pure malice the whole way. Now,
my favorite review was a superiority complex, both compelling and repellent.
That is amazing. That is just amazing. All right. Here's what I want to close with. A lot of times you jokingly, people will ask, you know, hey, ask me anything you want. And you always ask, what's your favorite thing about me?
What do you like best about me?
What do you like best about me? That's right. What do you like best about me? And I asked something similar to that to Matt Welch when he was on my show, just because I was playing with him a little bit, because I led up to it, making him think I was about to ask him a really controversial, difficult thing. And then I asked him, you know, what do you like best about Michael Malice? So I'm not going to ask you, what do you like best about me? I'm going to ask you, what do you like best about Michael Malice? What's your best quality?
It's my best quality. I mean, it would depend on what do you mean by best and in what context.
What's the quality that makes you the happiest about yourself?
I guess being self-made, I would say.
Oh, that's good.
I mean, because I'm self-taught, I know how I know what I know, right? So I'm wrong in a lot of things, but I'm not repeating it because someone told me. I'm repeating it because I read in a book and maybe my thinking was incorrect. But I can trace back where my thinking came from. And that also gives you a sense of security, because if someone is, I mean, I was just doing this on one of my live streams. The point I made is I go, look, I feel, and I don't think this is much of a leap, that the people who support me on Patreon and they give me the super chats and live stream, I'm the guy who's publicly saying what they wish they could, but they have to worry about their jobs. And now this is my job. So when I'm on Twitter and I'm really going ham on people, I can see why they're supportive. And I'm glad that I could be that person, as pompous as it sounds, that can, you know, swing those bats and hit people in the head who need to get hit in the head. And, you know, here's the one other thing. There was someone who I, of course, blocked immediately that made the points like, oh, how can you be excited that Trump Jr. followed you on Twitter? And it's like, yeah, why would an anarchist who cares about North Korea want to talk possibly the president? That makes no sense. That's stupid. That's a hypocrisy. Like, what? This is the goal.
I know it.
And here's the other, one more point. Oh my gosh. One of your listeners, and whoever you are, I will have contempt for you until the day I die. And I'm going to tell this, and this is for two reasons. One, an irrational reason, and one, a rational reason. I remember when I was in high school or junior high, my mom was really upset at me, and this was very out of character for her. And she ripped up one of my comic books. She was saying it was a waste of my time. And I remember which comic book it was too. It was a Firestorm issue. And years later, I'm a comic book character. So it's like, not only was your perception wrong, you were so damn sure that you were ripping up my comic book in front of me. And you could not be more wrong, right? And there was this guy on Twitter who told me, you're an accomplished man. This trolling is beneath you. Well, this trolling has me having the president's ear, doesn't it, now? So maybe you don't know what the heck you're talking about. You should shut up.
Wow, somebody said that to one of my people?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no.
Whoever you are, I will never, ever, ever have anything other than complete contempt for you. Because not only should you not be telling me your opinion, no one asked you, you were demonstrably wrong.
Well, not to mention, well, I mean, look, we could spend a lot of time on this, but there is something to what you do that, I mean, not only should we, anyway, it's hard to do what you do, first of all.
But you know what else? There's nothing wrong with having fun.
Yeah.
What I hate is this idea that we have, and Rand has this, but she doesn't. She says it, but she doesn't act that way, that you have to be intense all the time. Like, that's kind of her characters are like that, but personally, she was not like that. She's like play solitaire. She liked to dance around to silly music. If you're, and this, I hate this idea in art, that if it's frivolous or silly, it's somehow less legitimate. That is evil.
What makes me crazy is when I get people responding, let's say, to my email newsletter or a tweet, and they say, why do you even bother addressing this argument or this person or whatever? You know, and I just answer with, because it's fun.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I get that strictly speaking, I could probably do other things. But look, I produce a podcast episode every single weekday. I send out 2 emails a day. I do constant. I'm not allowed to enjoy myself once in a while. Well, this doesn't read like a PhD dissertation to me. So oh my gosh, where's the block function?
And you know what else? If you're fun, maybe people are going to be a little more receptive to hearing your serious arguments because that humanizes you.
Right.
Idiot. That's not directed to you. It's directed to whoever that listener is.
I appreciate that. All right. So people now, if they haven't already been following Michael Malice, are going to want to do that. Now, Twitter is a great place.
You got to give him a warning label. I think I might be a little too much for some of your audience.
Yeah, all right. But, you know, any group of people, there could be something about you or me that all of a sudden they find out, but they can't stand. But sure. But there's something wrong with those people, because you should. I mean, sometimes I actually go at the end of the day, I'm just relaxing and I don't want to answer any more emails or anything like that, I just look at your Twitter feed. I see what you're up to on a given day, and I enjoy it. So it's very easy to remember. It's just twitter.com/MichaelMalice. Michael Malice.
You know, and I got to tell you, I'm shocked, because I've had some tweets like over the weekend, and I thought, okay, I'm going to get a mass unfollowing, and I don't. And I'm like, this deserves an unfollowing. This is crossing a line. I'm not kidding. I was shocked.
Wow. Well, does that make you more impressed with your followers or just surprised?
I guess it speaks to my ignorance, because I thought I had an understanding. And I'm like, I don't know what happened here. I have no thesis. Hypothesis, rather.
At some point, I want to talk to you about, I'm not sure if you want me to say this here, but you were saying on one of your live streams that you're kicking around the idea of a book on trolling. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, I how to troll, T-R-O-L. I have like 5 book ideas to follow up the new right. And I may be doing something like, I think Tim Ferriss did something like this, where I'll do a GoFundMe, and for every dollar you kick in, you know, you kick in 10 bucks, you get the book, right? But for every dollar you kick in, you get a vote. And basically, whichever first past the post, that's the book I'll do.
Ah, okay.
Because there's so many ideas I have that are good. How to troll is, because it wouldn't be just about how to troll. It's also about understanding the programming that the median person has, and also the programming that, you know, the corporate press is putting into people.
I think it'd be a great book, but I have a strategy for it that I'd want to talk to you about off the air.
I'm not going to make a free ebook, Tom.
I'm not just a one trick pony, you know.
That's your answer to everything.
it is my answer to everything.
I had mice. He goes, send them a free ebook. It doesn't make sense. They don't speak English. They're Russian mice.
All right. So would you say Twitter is where you would most want people to follow? I mean, you have a website, michaelmalice.com, but is Twitter where you most want people to follow you at this point?
I don't know about want. I mean, I have a lot of fun as you join in on the live streams. So that's been
really true.
An entertaining thing.
Michael Malice YouTube channel. I'll link to that also on the show notes page. Yeah.
What I've been doing is having these little history lessons. Like, I'll get a rare book and I'll tell the story of it. And people are really into that stuff, because I've got idiosyncratic interests historically. It's stuff that people wouldn't have heard of, you know, me being a hipster.
So there's plenty of ways, depending on the type of content you want, plenty of ways to follow Michael. And you're right. I sometimes pop into your live streams. And then I try to be subdued in the comments, because it's your thing. And
I want you not to be subdued.
But it's your thing. I don't want it to be, oh, look, Woods is here. Now Woods wants attention.
I'm not subdued here. I'm on your show, aren't I?
Yeah, that's true. But well, first of all, I enjoy watching, because your interaction with everybody is great. I'm always interested in your thoughts. Sometimes you'll say something that completely takes me by surprise. And I wasn't expecting him to have that.
Oh, give me one example of that.
Now, I knew you were going to say that. I can't. I'm going to have to start noting them.
Okay.
I'll have to start. But where things where I'll say, you know what? I can imagine him thinking that, come to think of it. Because every once in a while, it's I'm not quite like the Soviet ambassador on Nightline who hasn't been updated from the Kremlin on what the new line is that he's supposed to be taking. You know, I'm not quite like that. Like, I have to hear Malice's view, but I'm always interested to hear your view on a lot of things. And sometimes you surprise me on what it is. And that's one of the reasons that I like to follow you, because there are plenty of people, I know exactly what their take is. I know exactly on everything. And sometimes, you know, a lot of these people they're right about a lot of things, but they're boringly right. You know, I'd rather have you be 10% of the time excitingly wrong, but at least it keeps me interested and makes me think.
I'm sure I'm wrong more than 10% of the time, but yeah, I agree with you. It's at least it's interesting.
Well, I think the thing to do is go to tomwoods.com/1345, pick a way to follow Michael Malice and stick with it, because I'd like to say you won't be disappointed. You probably will, but you might get a few golden nuggets out of it all the same.
Great delivery, Tom. Great work.
Thanks, Michael. Oh, by the way, that was thanks for being on the show. Like, this is over. Yep. So that was thanks for being on the show. All right. All right. Get out of here.
All right, folks, make sure and check out Michael's Patreon, patreon.com/MichaelMalice. Give Michael some support. He's doing great work, and it's tremendous that people like Michael are able to do that work because people who appreciate it go over there and give him a few smackers. So check that out, patreon.com/MichaelMalice. All the stuff we've been talking about, it'll be linked at tomwoods.com/1345. Now, here's an anti-Michael Malice thing, because Michael does not like cruises. I am going to say before we wrap up for today, make sure you book your cabin for the Contra Cruise 2019. We're setting sail for Alaska. It's going to be amazing, and I'm going to be debating Bob Murphy. And that debate, well, I'm planning to beat him even worse than I beat Michael Malice on Alexander Hamilton. So go reserve your cabin for the Libertarian event of the year over at ContraCruise.com, and I'll see you tomorrow. And by the way, we got a juicy one tomorrow, one of the best ones in a long time. So thanks for listening.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.